Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. And for our virtual listeners, we hope you stay glued to kptz.org. Our website is more than just a way to listen to today's shows. For example, you can look at the biographies of all of our hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to see what's happening around town. And you can even sample some of our earlier shows. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as podcasts. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some of earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who are the tourists flocking to town in ever-growing numbers? How do they find out about Port Townsend? Someone told me that the Lonely Planet is one of the places that features this town. Who are the locals loudly arguing politics on Saturday morning down at the soda fountain at Don's Pharmacy? And who is the young father juggling one baby in a tummy pouch and another toddler in a stroller? He's a brave young man, that's for sure. This show, Our Town, profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work in Jefferson County. We talk with the people who make up this eclectic mix around the peninsula. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up living on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otters, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is a longtime local with quite an interesting, if indeed somewhat clandestine, background. Bob Snow is now a Macintosh computer geek, but in his previous life, long, long time ago, he was once a counterintelligence agent. Yes, you know, a spy. So welcome to the show, Bob. Before we get to the secret stuff, let's talk a little about your background. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in what was a much smaller town called Sacramento, California, and I'm a third-generation Sacramentan. Stayed there through high school and then went to the University of California, Berkeley for 4 years. Haven't been back to Sacramento to live since then.
Well, I come from a place I don't go back to all that much either. Were you the kind of kid that was very focused, that knew what you wanted to be when you grew up?
No, absolutely not. I started out as a pre-med student thinking, oh, well, I might want to be a doctor someday, and spent about 2 years. And then after taking zoology and organic chemistry and a few other things, decided that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And switched to business administration, and that's my graduate effort. I got a BS degree from Berkeley.
And while you were in Berkeley, you told me earlier you were in the ROTC program.
Yeah, I was. I'd been in ROTC actually in high school, and then went on to continue that in college, and graduated as a distinguished military cadet from the University of California, and spent about 3 months making hamburgers and milkshakes while I was waiting for my commission to be activated, and then went into military service.
Some of our listeners might not be aware of this, but in that era, basically the draft was on, and there wasn't much choice for young men. You were basically going to go into the military one way or the other. And there were some advantages to going in by way of the ROTC. Can you explain that?
I was at a time, incidentally, that sort of was after Korea and before Vietnam, so a relatively quiet time in the history of the United States. But the draft certainly was there, and I was interested in possibly pursuing a military career. So I continued ROTC after high school, and upon graduation, then I had a 3-year commitment as a young lieutenant, and that sort of started me out in the military side of things some 60 years ago or so.
And did you have much choice in what you ended up doing in the military?
Well, yes and no. Normally, you don't have any choice. You just sort of go into a branch. You can ask for the branch of service that you want to serve in, and you might get it, you might not. But I was in a category called Distinguished Military Cadet. You have to be in the upper one-third of your academic class and 10% of your military class, and then you can opt to get a regular army commission, which means you went into the infantry, the artillery, or the armor, or the engineers. I didn't want to do any of those things. I was interested in military intelligence for some strange reason. And so as a distinguished military cadet, I got to select that branch of service. And so that's where I wound up doing my 4.5 years.
You were interested in intelligence from the beginning. Was that because you read a lot of spy books?
No, not really. I just thought it would be much more interesting than being in the infantry.
I can see that. So, but what did it actually mean? What did they train you for?
Well, it depends on what branch of the military you're in and what particular subunit you are. There's, at that time, and this now we're talking 60 years ago, a long time ago, military intelligence didn't have its own branch like the infantry. You had components, and I was in the what they call the counterintelligence corps, and that's the sort of the FBI. It's really not the spy business at all. It's sort of an investigative arm and a security arm of the army. And there was another group that did the spy work, if you will, and I wasn't part of that one so much as I was trained as an investigator.
And so counterintelligence, what do they teach you?
Well, you can think of it as what you want to do to prevent the army, in this case, from being vulnerable to security penetration. So largely, you're doing background investigations in the United States for security clearances before someone goes into the military, or in this case, into the army. And so they teach you how to do an interview, what things to look for in a person's background that might lead to them being vulnerable to bribery or some other form of coercion. You're looking for what it is that makes a person tick and what might be a problem down the line for them.
So you're looking for things that people might be blackmailed on.
Well, imagine that if someone has a drinking habit or extramarital affairs or heavily in debt, that can be found out pretty easily. And then they can manipulate you into working for them. This would be some hostile intelligence organization, for instance. So you can weed out people that have that kind of background. In addition, you look for background connections with foreign countries. Does the person have a foreign-born wife or family members who may be vulnerable in a foreign country over which you don't have any control, and therefore you might be vulnerable? So you're looking for essentially that could cause problems down the line.
Well, this foreign connection, it still exists today. It's just clinking into place in my head. A relative of mine was applying for a job in the defense industry, and she was asked to disclose if any of her relatives were foreign nationals or had spent any time in a different country. And since I'm a dual citizen, Canada and the U.S., she had to disclose that. And it didn't occur to me till right now that that was what's probably going on.
Could very well be. But, you know, my experience is ancient history.
Yes.
compared with what's going on today. So I can't speak to any of that because I haven't done that for many, many years.
Once they got you trained, where'd they send you?
Well, at the end of the training, you have some choices about specialty training and or languages.
Right.
And I wanted to go to the Army Language School, as it was then called in Monterey, and learn a Western European language like, German or French or Spanish. Those are my first three choices. And I was offered Bulgarian, Czech, and Russian.
So I thought,
well, of those three languages, maybe Russian might be used down the line or might be a little bit more interesting or widely spoken. So I elected to do that. I went to Monterey for a full year of intensive foreign language training and then was sent to Germany for 3 years, during which time I never used the Russian.
Of course.
But I did learn German, so there was an offset.
That's good. And how long did you spend in Germany?
I was 3 years there, and I was with a counterintelligence organization in southern Germany.
And is Germany your only foreign posting, or did you have others?
No, I was, while I was in Germany, I took the foreign service test and eventually passed that and all the background checks and went into the U.S. Information Agency as a new foreign service officer. In that case, the choices worked out. They asked me and others in my class where we wanted to go, and I said Brazil, and I thought that was kind of neat. I had seen Black Orpheus, so I knew that that was a colorful place to go.
Yes.
And lo and behold, I got the assignment in Brazil. So I went off to Brazil and spent a year in training in Rio de Janeiro, and which included 12 weeks of Portuguese language training, and then went off to Recife in northeast Brazil, and spent 2 years as a combination of cultural affairs officer and information officer for USIS there.
That must have been really amazing experience.
Well, it was difficult times and very positive times. The Alliance for Progress, the U.S. aid program, was hugely popular and very much focused on Brazil, and I represented the information arm of that organization. In addition to that, when I arrived in Brazil, the government 3 years later was overthrown and went from a left-leaning to a right-leaning military organization. So we had a switch in politics and relationships, and those were interesting and difficult times.
Wow. And so did you come back to the U.S. after that assignment?
Yeah, I did. I had two of my daughters were born in Brazil, one of whom lives here in Port Townsend. And the options are not good health-wise for young, very young children in the Amazon, for instance, which is where I was going to be sent next. And I just decided it was just a little too hazardous for the family to take that assignment. So I managed to get reassigned back in Washington to the domestic service and eventually wound up as one of several personnel officers for the Voice of America in Washington, D.C.
And how long did you stay in Washington?
I was about a year and a half to 2 years, close to 2 years, and finally was ready to leave the East Coast, return home to the West Coast somehow, and so I managed to find a job at Fort Ord, California as a management employee relations person, spent about a year there, and then moved to Monterey to the Defense Language Institute. It was then called Army Language School. And spent the rest of my career either there or overseas working for the Defense Department.
Well, Monterey's not a bad place to be posted.
I think it's kind of nice.
You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. The show's called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest is Bob Snow, who has just been telling us about his various overseas postings, mainly as a counterintelligence agent for the U.S. government, different agencies. He ended up coming back to Monterey, California. What was your career path there in Monterey?
Well, eventually I moved from recruitment and training at the language school to management employee relations, and eventually became the personnel officer, the civilian side. There were about 1,500 employees there, about 700 on the faculty. It's one of the largest language schools in the world. And I moved from there to assignments as personnel officers overseas with the Armed Forces Recreation Center and the community in Ansbach, and I did an assignment in Stuttgart and another in Berlin when the wall was still up. And each time after the 3 to 5 years overseas, I came back to the Army Language School or Defense Language Institute.
Nice.
And retired from there after Fort Ord closed in 1994.
And when you were retiring, did you have a clear vision of where you wanted to go, what you wanted to do?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
We were looking for a place to retire that we would enjoy, and we found at that time the area in Northern California we liked was either too expensive, too smoggy, or too crowded. And we had traveled up here and visited my sister, who was then living in Port Townsend, and liked the area very much, and so bought a lot up here in the Port Townsend area, and eventually, when I retired, built a house and been here ever since.
Wow. And you're not the kind of guy to retire. How did you end up getting involved with the computer industry?
Well, I started with my first Apple computer back in 1980, so that was pretty primitive by today's standard, but I've had an Apple device ever since then and just enjoy the geek side of things, working with it, learning about it. And I've used it in some of the businesses that I work for temporarily. I had odd jobs after I retired and kept learning more about the Mac and Apple devices and decided, well, why don't I go into troubleshooting and training for these devices? And that developed into later iPods and iPads. And so I sort of do that as part-time work simply because I enjoy it a lot.
So now you're a consultant for people who need help on Mac equipment. Yes.
Right. Anything sort of Apple related, I help people out with training and things.
And you also are an officer of a group called PT Slug that I'm not sure all of our listeners know about. So can you tell us what PT Slug is?
Well, it's an interesting name for the Northwest. I think the slug thing they worked with first and then backed into the name because it became known as the Port Townsend Seriously Laid-Back User Group. When I joined in 1995, there were all of five or so members, and so they asked me to be the president, and I couldn't just sort of sit still, so I tried to build up the organization, and eventually we got it up to about 70 to 80 members and began training classes and regular meetings and put out a newsletter at one time and eventually had a website. And the group survives and still works today in Port Townsend and this whole area. We have regular meetings once a month and free classes to our workshops. And basically, we try to help people with their Apple devices, learn more about them, and solve problems for them. It's an all-volunteer Washington nonprofit.
Okay. And the website is what?
It's ptslug.org, not .com.
Yes, okay.
And you can learn all about that.
Yeah, and on the website, of course, you are featured there. And so if people wanted to get in touch with you, that's one way to do it, to go through the website.
Right.
And you mentioned the classes that the group runs. Can you give us an example of one or two different topics that might be happening or happened?
Well, about 9 months a year, we do two-hour workshops. And this focuses on different things Apple. It may be about iPads and iPhones, or it may be about the Macs, or both. Our most recent one was a two-hour session on privacy and scams that go on. And I think the people had a lot of fun and learned some things about their privacy practices that are going on. Prior to that, we had a class on iPad and iPhone cameras and editing, and we're going to continue that in June.
Okay. This privacy, it seems it's more and more, it's more and more of a concern for people. Privacy. How do you protect yourself? What are some of the simpler steps you can take?
Well, I recommend that you don't respond to any emails from Bulgaria.
Yeah.
But beyond that,
that prince in Uganda is okay?
Yeah. There's $50 million offered to you by someone from Nigeria. Take it up because it's a great opportunity.
Yeah.
But we alerted people to how people are doing what they call phishing, which is essentially trying to get you to give up information about yourself, whether it's your passwords or it's personal information or get into your computer. You go to a website that warns you that we have just found terrible viruses on your computer. Immediately, we're going to shut you down. Call this number within 5 minutes, and our technical people will get rid of the viruses, which is always interesting because it takes me about 20 to 30 minutes to scan my computer for viruses, and they found out in 3 seconds. You've got to wonder about that.
They're very sophisticated.
People do panic, and they do call these numbers and sometimes give away their credit card to get specious technical support. But there are also other phishing scams where they're looking for passwords and things like that. And it's just a good idea to be suspicious of any call or anything you get on the web that you didn't ask for. And sometimes even things from friends. Simple things like getting an email that says, this is a really funny video. And in the text area, there is no, hi, Bob, this is something you might want to see. There's just a link. Do not click on links. Do not unsubscribe to specious FedEx emails and things like that. So it's just being very cautious as you would with a stranger that came to your door.
Well, okay, you just said something that wouldn't have occurred to me. You said, do not unsubscribe, because I thought if you unsubscribe, that helped get rid of things.
Yeah, it does if it's a legitimate website. Mm-hmm. You have to determine yourself whether it's really a legitimate website. And you do that by, I'd say, Googling, but that's just another word for searching on the website for that particular business and seeing if it's legitimate. Because if it's a scam, probably someone will have picked it up and put it on the internet. So if you unsubscribe, that takes you to their website, whether it's a bad one or a good one. If it's a bad one, they can put things on your computer or do other things you don't want them to do. So make sure that if you have an interaction with some internet email or something like that, it is legitimate.
Okay. Now, here's one that I've heard about. Like a lot of people, I type quickly and sometimes not completely accurately. So let's say I typed in, instead of apple.com, I typed in apple.cm. What happens there?
That has an interesting name. It's called typo squatting.
Typo squatting, okay.
And it's essentially people in Bermuda or China or even this country who have bought up email addresses that are kin to things like Apple, but it's .cm instead of .com, and commonly people make typos. Instead of typing .org, they may type .og, mm-hmm. and that takes them to a website where something unpleasant probably will happen, or at least you'll be tempted to do something, or they'll get something from you. So the way you avoid that kind of thing is bookmark your websites and then use the bookmark to get there. Don't type it in.
Okay, so less room for error if you use a bookmark.
Right.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Now, this is sort of related, but I've been seeing a lot about Alexa, not just Alexa, to be fair. There are many, other devices, but they just sort of listen to you, right?
Some do, and they're waiting to hear their name. There's Siri on Apple devices, Alexa. And once they hear your name, they're alert and want to know what they can do for you. You heard about the recent incident where someone was sent a random conversation because Alexa thought it heard its name, and then it thought it asked who do you want to contact, and it heard something in the background that sounded like some name in its contact list. So it prepared an email to that person and then it said, what do you want to say? And the people talking didn't hear that, and so it heard the random conversation and recorded that. And then send it off.
Wow.
So you have to be a little careful with devices like that.
Well, yes, but what about your smart TVs?
Well, that's interesting because there are, on the recent TVs called smart TVs, a service, and I put that in quotes, to offer you enhanced experience even on your television. Essentially, it records your television habits, where you go, what you watch, how long you watch it, even if you're recording a program. And by default, that used to be on when you bought a particular TV set. Now, I think they're mostly probably by default off and you have to turn them on. But if you have an older set and it's a so-called smart TV, you might want to check the settings and see if, in fact, they're providing you with this, quote, service, unquote, to keep track, because they essentially sell this data, your browsing habits, your internet habits, to people that might be interested.
Okay, so basically, you could be at home in the privacy of your own living room watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and they would record that, and then what would they do with it?
Well, they might want to sell it to firms that would use it to a certain demographic that are interested, say, in people who typically watch the Kardashians. So there are uses that could be made with all of your personal habits and data, and the TV companies were no exception. They took advantage of that. It's part of a whole world called the Internet of Things, which are non-computer objects that, in fact, have computer chips in them, from refrigerators to TV sets to other devices in your home.
They have washing machines now that you can turn on from your cell phone if you're 200 miles away.
Now, that can be very handy unless a break in the line,
yes,
and come home to a flooded room.
It's very strange, very strange. I don't know.
The problem with the whole Internet of Things non-computer is these companies, by and large, didn't build in privacy and security features into these devices. So you have to be very careful about using them.
Okay, we're running pretty short on time, but I did want to cover one other thing. You were telling me about a book called The Art of Invisibility by Kevin Mitnick. Can you give us briefly what that covers?
This is Mitnick's second book. He was a professional hacker, made money at this until the FBI got caught up with him. And I don't know if he did jail time, but I think he probably worked with the FBI for a while and now is a computer consultant. And he will tell you more than you ever want to know about privacy and security of devices. He weaves the story around being invisible on the internet, but in the process, you learn about things like Bitcoin and how your cell phone tracks you and what you can do about it. And if you enjoy a bit of a detective yarn and also want to learn how to be a little safer with your modern devices, you might want to consider either listening to the audio tape or reading the book.
Wow, so that's The Art of Invisibility. And I guess it's relatively difficult to be invisible.
It's not easy. You know, some people are get bitcoins and think they're anonymous, but there are ways to trace that. There are ways that law enforcement agencies can track people using their own secret cell towers and your habits of using your phone, and then they can sort of narrow down where you live and go after you if you're a person of interest.
Well, even buying a burner phone isn't very private unless you take certain steps. Like what? Tell us.
Well, in the book, he describes you want to get a burner phone at the local market, and you go in and buy the phone. And if you use a credit card, you can be traced and that number tied to the phone. If you use cash, not as easily. But what about the video camera that may be recording the transaction? So he says, if you really want to be anonymous and buy a burner phone, pay somebody $100 and give them cash and have them go into the store and buy the phone for you and come out, and you hope that they give you the burner phone when they come out. But he says it's very, very difficult to be truly anonymous on the internet.
Do you think he tries it himself to be anonymous?
Well, he has tried it, as a matter of fact.
Good.
And got caught at it by making cell phone calls anonymously from his cell phone in the same location. Eventually, the law enforcement narrowed it down to where he lived and arrested him. But it was because he didn't make the cell phone calls from different places in town.
So keep on moving.
If you want to be anonymous.
Okay, well, we're basically running out of time here. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who make up the fabric of this community. I'm Marianne McNellis. Today, my guest has been Bob Snow, who has a fascinating background as a James Bond-type character, although he downplays it. In his current life, however, he's a computer aficionado who takes great pride in solving the mysteries of the Mac. And by the way, he does give private lessons. He's one of the officers of PT Slug, Port Townsend's seriously laid-back computer users. And thank you, Bob, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
I also want to thank my editor in the glass booth, Sonny Flores. He's today's engineer and editor of Our Town. Like all good editors, he makes me and my guests sound so much smoother on air. He takes out all those funny burps and gulps and errs. I also want to thank program director Larry Stein, station manager Kate Ingram, and our chair, Robert Ambrose. They all work extremely hard to make KPTZ an amazing community radio station. I want to thank you for listening. Remember that KPTZ is a listener-supported community station. That means we need your donations, but we also need more volunteers down here to help make this a better station. Please keep your radio tuned to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by Sonny Flores.